1 Kings chapter 3, let me pray for our evening. Father, we love you, we praise you, we are so blessed that you are here and you are so for us and love us so much. And Lord, you want to teach us some lessons through the life of Solomon, the wisest man that ever lived, and yet the capability of our flesh to rival and in fact defeat wisdom is a powerful lesson, Lord. And so would you teach us tonight and remind us you have given us all power to win this life and be victorious as followers of Jesus. So bless us, we pray, Lord. Would you fill us with your Spirit? And we thank you and praise you for that and all you're going to do. And we ask in Jesus' name. Amen. All right. If you remember the last couple of chapters, we've now seen Solomon fully enthroned. So he has been placed by his dad, King David, on the throne. The Lord had told him many years before, if you recall, that he would be the king after David's death. And of course, there was a play for the throne with Adonijah, his brother, and some others joined with him, Joab and others. And Solomon has already had, as a very young man, believed to be again 16 to 19 years old or so when he took over the throne, already had to immediately deal with these issues and remove some of these people. You know, you look at Adonijah attempting to take the throne and then through subversion try to take over the throne even after the original attempt. And so very clearly he needed to be removed and treasonous. And so he had to have him taken out. Joab, because of some murders he had committed earlier in life, he was taken out. So all of this is kind of brewing. And here's this young man hoping to come in and do a good job and be a good king. And praise the Lord. The Lord is going to give him some tremendous wisdom. Unfortunately, as we begin this chapter, we're going to see kind of a mixed bag in the first few verses and some unfortunate glimpses into some of the mistakes he's going to make. We remember David had a couple of great mistakes. He wasn't a good father in terms of disciplining his children. He had a serious weakness for women. Solomon's going to have that same weakness, really almost towards all of his flesh. But he's going to have that problem as well. And some cutting some corners when it comes to worshiping the Lord. So unfortunately, we begin with this little bit of a mixed bag here in the beginning. And so let's look at, before he is given great wisdom from the Lord, let's pick up in verse 1. Now Solomon made a treaty with Pharaoh, king of Egypt. There's nothing wrong with making a treaty with somebody. That's a good thing. Solomon's going to be really, really blessed and fairly unique for a king of Israel. That he's pretty much going to spend basically his whole adult life as a king really at peace. And he's going to really be blessed. And so in the beginning, though, here he makes a treaty with Pharaoh, king of Egypt, which is wise to secure the southern border so that he can protect himself from your neighbors. So last thing you want to know is when you're in a country that has contentious, potentially contentious neighbors, those that have enslaved you in the past, that they can be a problem. And so he forms this treaty with him. Now, lots of times treaties are broken, but for him it won't be. So he's going to actually enjoy this peace. Now, unfortunately, notice that a woman came with the deal. So, common practice back in these days that there would be these intermarrying of two nations, and they would hope at least during that generation to hold the peace by having people get married. So you're fighting family here if you get involved in a fight. But he married a Pharaoh's daughter, and of course in bringing her, that wouldn't have been all that kosher, would it have been for the other Jews to have this Egyptian princess come and become one of the wives of the king? There shouldn't have been wives, plural, at all, but she does become one of them. And so he brought her to the city of David. Now, he only had her stay there until he built a house, and then he shipped her out. In fact, in chapter 7, verse 8, it talks about him building a house for her. Chapter 7, verse 8, Solomon also made a house like this hall for Pharaoh's daughter, whom he had taken as wife. Now, right away you see, okay, is this going to be a problem? We're going to see a serious problem with him and women. And now there's not a specific prohibition that we necessarily know of for him to not intermarry with some women outside the land. We know they were not supposed to marry women in the land because of the real serious idolatry that they were involved in. Let me remind you, in Exodus 34, we read, "Lest you make a covenant with the inhabitants of the land, and they play the harlot with their gods and make sacrifice to their gods. One of them invites you, and you eat of his sacrifice. You take of his daughters for your sons and his daughters play the harlot with their gods and make your sons play the harlot with their gods. So they were not to intermarry with the women of the land, the people of the land. And then in Deuteronomy 7, in speaking to the generation that actually entered the land after the 40 years wandering in the wilderness, we read, "Nor shall you make marriages with them. You shall not give your daughter to their son, nor take their daughter for your son, for they will turn your sons away from following me to serve other gods. So the anger of the Lord will be aroused against you and destroy you suddenly." And sadly, that is going to happen to Solomon. These women he loves are going to draw his heart away and begin to worship these false gods. So it's sad. So we really begin to see this kind of slippery slope that he's going down. Remember, he's going to marry 700 women, 300 concubines, 1,000 wives. That's insane. So, I mean, it's just crazy, but that's what he's going to do. Now, in 1 Kings 11, we're going to read, here it is, "King Solomon loved many foreign women." So we're not that many chapters away. "As well as the daughter of Pharaoh, women of the Moabites, Ammonites, Edomites, Sidonians, Hittites." So he starts with a woman outside the land, but ends up marrying a whole bunch of women in the land. A complete violation of God's law. And so from the nations of whom the Lord had said to the children of Israel, speaking of the women in the land, "You shall not intermarry with them, nor they with you. Surely they will turn your hearts after their gods." Solomon clung to these in love, 700 wives, princesses, 300 concubines, and his wives turned away his heart. So it did happen. And here's the beginning of it. Now, part of me, it's interesting, I'm just suspecting. I don't really think it would have changed it, but isn't it a little interesting the Lord points this out before he gets wisdom that he makes this mistake? You wonder, like, okay, maybe before he got the wisdom, he made this mistake, but he's going to still give fully into his flesh after he gets the wisdom. So I kind of mentioned it last week, but we talk about there's a great importance for education and learning truth and learning right and wrong. And we teach, and it's interesting in many of the schools today, oh, if we just educate our children, but that's not all of it by far. We need to educate our children with a fear of the Lord. That combination, our children will be successful if they fear the Lord. And so when we're teaching them what to do right without any basis of a fear in the Lord, well, there's no power behind that. So here he is making this mistake. And, of course, Deuteronomy 17, the kings were told not to multiply wives. And in that same couple of verses, the kings were to write out the law in their own hand, every king of Israel, so that there was no ignorance of violating these laws. And as wise as he was, he would have remembered this. Anyway, it's sad that we see this beginning that's going to really be one of his downfalls. Verse 2, "Meanwhile, the people sacrificed at the high places because there was no house built for the name of the Lord until those days." Now, this, I believe, is a mistake as well. So we see the two areas where he's going to really cut corners, particularly with women and worship of the Lord. Now, you'll notice there's almost like a little bit of an excuse here, this "because there was no house built for the name of the Lord." I'm going to remind you of a couple of rules the Lord had given them when they came into the land about the high places. They were supposed to wipe them out. In fact, it's interesting as we go later through the kings, one of the things the Lord consistently points out when a king takes over is whether or not he removed the high places. It's a big deal to the Lord because the pagan practices mainly believed that if you get higher up on a mountain, you're closer to God, and so it's better, and somehow God hears you better. It's really an insult to their God. What, is he so puny? You need to be close to him to hear you? I mean, you need a new God when you got a guy that's hard of hearing. So is this? If your God has male selective hearing, you need a new God. So anyway, here's the issue. So they were to wipe out the high places. But the Lord, it seems to make a little bit of an allowance because they hadn't fully established the one single great place, which will be the temple with Solomon later, to come and worship. And we do know, let me read verse 3 before we read this rule about the high places. Notice, Solomon loved the Lord. It's good to know he did love the Lord here. And he ended up making great mistakes, and we can all make great mistakes even when we seriously love the Lord, walking in the statutes of his father David, except... So it seems like a little bit of an exception in verse 2, but in verse 3, the Lord points out it was still a mistake, except that he sacrificed and burned incense at the high places. So let me remind you of what the Lord had said. Back in Numbers 33, the Lord spoke through Moses and said, "Speak to the children of Israel and say to them, when you cross the Jordan into the land of Canaan, then you drive out all the inhabitants of the land from before you." And here it is, "Destroy their engraved stones, destroy all their molded images, and destroy all their high places." He didn't want them worshiping at the high places. They were pagan sites. Now, God can redeem anything, but he didn't want them worshiping at these. In Deuteronomy 12, then to the generation entering the land, Deuteronomy 12, 2, you shall utterly destroy all the places where the nations which you shall dispossess serve their gods on the high mountains and on the hills and under every green tree. He wanted it all wiped out. Now, if they had no place to worship, they should have just worshiped the Lord and waited until the place was built. Better that than go to a place he clearly said, don't go worship. So that's a lesson for us. Sometimes we don't know what to do. We need to just do nothing and wait on the Lord until he provides the final answer in whatever situation we're dealing with. They made that mistake. Now, there were other rules around where they were to worship. For example, if you remember, regarding food, when they were traveling around with the tabernacle, they all lived around it. So they were never allowed to kill an animal just to eat. They had to always bring it like a peace offering to the Lord and then share the meal with the Lord, and they could take the meat. Once they get into the promised land, he said, if you live far away, you can kill an animal just for eating purposes. If you want to offer it to the Lord, you had to go to the place, which ultimately ended up being Jerusalem and the building of the temple. So these different rules. But high places, those are off the list. So some believe the Lord gave a little bit of leeway in that, you remember, they got in for a time. Shiloh was the place, and then the tabernacle, the ark got captured, and then finally David brought it back to Jerusalem. I'm still saying, though, it's my opinion, the Lord was very clear they should not have gone to the high places. So I just see a little bit of cutting corners here, which is sin. I don't want to say cutting corners as if that's okay, like a little white lie. It's still a lie. It's still wrong. So this would be wrong. So I don't want to give the impression it's okay. But some think that maybe there was some patience with the Lord here for them. But I think it's a sign Solomon's willing to cut corners, and it's going to cost him greatly later. So anyway, that's what's going on. Notice verse 4, the king went to Gibeon to sacrifice there, for that was the great high place. Solomon offered 1,000 burnt offerings on that altar. Now, that's quite a sacrifice. But I don't care how big the sacrifice is, it's still wrong. So sometimes we can think, people might think, oh, if I give a lot of money to the Lord or something. No, it doesn't work that way. It doesn't work that way. He cares about obedience, not sacrifice. He cares much more for our hearts and our obedience, and so we never want to forget that. So I just believe the Lord inserted this, I believe, early on to see the glimpses into what's going to end up being his struggles. And it's interesting because every one of us as Christians, we have 1, 2, 3 areas that are our personal struggle in life. You've got your struggle. Somebody else got there. One of the reasons we need to be very gracious with other people, you may look at them and go, oh, I'd never struggle with that. Well, yeah, but there's things you struggle with they probably don't, and they can look at you and think the same thing. Just weird how our flesh has our own particular weakness. They have their particular, let's care for each other, love one another, encourage one another, all these things. So we know that Solomon had his weak points. And they are pointed out for us for our edification. Let's not cut corners with the Lord. Okay, at Gibeon, the Lord appeared to Solomon in a dream by night. Now, this really happened. It's in a dream. We've got to be really careful with dreams. Some people are really big today on dreams, and God speaks in dreams. Unless it's confirmed by his word or some other thing, we've got to be very, very careful. But this really did happen. The Lord really came to Solomon in a dream. And notice what he said. Ask, what shall I give you? Wow. Would that be great if you went to sleep tonight and the Lord did that for you? It'd be fun to go around the room and ask, what would you ask if the Lord said, lay it on me. What do you want? Wow. Would you want riches? Fame? Would you want to know the Lord and be a great evangelist? What would you want? What would you want? Would you want to be able to communicate God's truth? Be an apostle, Paul? What would you want? It's a great question to ask ourselves. What do I want my legacy to be? Do I want it to be the Lord? What do I want it to be? Now, we're going to see three things the Lord points out that I think are very, very common things people ask for. Because he's going to be almost amazed that Solomon didn't ask for one of these three things. So it's beautiful. There was really a tender heart in Solomon to do the right thing, even though he's going to end up making some serious mistakes. So here it is. Solomon said, you've shown great mercy to your servant David, my father. And I love what he's going to say in this verse. He's acknowledging, you blessed my dad, and I know you blessed him. It was your hand, your great God, God of great mercy. And notice the word because in verse 6. That's the reason word. Why the Lord blessed David. Because he walked before you in truth, in righteousness, and in the uprightness of heart with you. and then he's going to go violate all that. That's what's really tragic. Solomon, even before he gets the wisdom, knew this. He had some wisdom as a young man, not anything like what the Lord's going to give him, but he knew truth. And so apparently some of that fear of the Lord is missing. But anyway, he lays this out. You've continued this great kindness for him. You've given him a son, he's speaking of himself, to sit on his throne as it is this day. And now here it is. Now, O Lord my God, you've made your servant king instead of my father David. I'm a little child. I do not know how to go in or to go out or to come in. I love that. That's tremendous humility. He is a young man. Now, he's probably, let's say he took over the throne at 16. He's probably about 19 or 20 now. Remember, he had Shimei, had this 3 years before he took off and found one of his slaves, or a couple of slaves down in Gath, and he killed him. And so now he's probably a good, maybe early 20s at this point. But he knows truth. But he still calls himself a little child. And I love the humility to say, you know, when I walk out of that like back room and go to sit on the throne, I didn't even know how to look like a king walking to the throne. I mean, I need help here. And I don't want to look like a fool. It wasn't all about him. He actually is going to ask for something that is incredibly other-centered, which is the way we're supposed to be as believers, thinking of what would bless other people. And so I don't know how to go out or come in. And your servant is in the midst of your people whom you've chosen, a great people, too numerous to be numbered or counted. He's about to say, I don't know how to take care of me, let alone a great number of people that you've called for me to lead. So I really need your help. So tremendous humility. I love this scene. Therefore, give to your servant an understanding heart. And by the way, you may notice in your the word understanding there, actually one of its greatest meanings is hearing. And it's even might be in your margins, many of your Bibles. It literally could read, therefore, give your servant a hearing heart to judge. I need to be able to really hear. You know, and we know there's one level of hearing. I joked about male selective hearing. We can hear something and not have a clue what they're saying, not really be paying attention, not get it. Sometimes we have to repeat what they said. Is this what you meant? I wouldn't want to hear what you have to say. So he wants to have a hearing heart to judge the people. And that was one of the great marks of David. He was a great judge, and he judged with justice. I mean, besides his personal faults, but he was a great king. And here it is. I want to be able to judge your people. Here's the reason. That I may discern between good and evil. For who is able to judge this great people of yours? Now remember, in that day, that if you had an issue with somebody, you'd come to local magistrates, local city rulers, city leaders. But sometimes issues couldn't get resolved, and they would make their way up to the king. And the king would actually hear cases and judge matters. It's like, I'm the king, and I don't know how to take care of myself. I really want to judge your people in a way that's pleasing to you, Lord. So I need you to give me the ability to hear and discern between good and evil. I need wisdom. I need to be able to take the facts and apply them in a way that makes sense and gets down to the heart of the matter. Well, this really pleased God. Of course it did. What he's wanting is not for himself to look great. It's to bless people and lead them properly. So this speech pleased the Lord. The Solomon had asked this thing. Now remember, he said this all in a dream. So this really was on his heart. I don't think you'd be making stuff up in your dream. I mean, this really is I almost think of it in the same way. Maybe I'm off, but you know, they say when you go and you learn another language, you really know the language when you're dreaming in that language. You know what I'm saying? It becomes so second nature that this was his desire to so bless the people. In his sleep, this is what he would ask for. I kind of think of it in that particular way. So this is really great. It really did please the Lord. And here's what the Lord said. Because you asked this thing, and he's going to abundantly above all he can ask or think, bless him mightily with tremendous gifts. But he's going to list, I think, the three things most commonly asked for by people when we come to the Lord. So he says, you've asked this thing. You've not asked for long life for yourself. That's a biggie. Long life for yourself. You haven't asked riches for yourself. That's a biggie. And you haven't asked for the life of your enemies. So it seems like the big three hits with the Lord are, let me live long, give me a lot of money to live long, and wipe out everybody that's against me. That'd be really great. Just smoke them and let me live unattested, uncontested, with all my money. That'd be really great. And so, I don't know. Do you just think the Lord just sits up there and going, oh my gosh, here we go again. Oh, man, you need to change your attitude. So I know he does that with me from time to time. So anyway, but you've asked but have asked for yourself understanding or hearing again to discern justice. And here's the Lord's blessing to him. Behold, I have done according to your words. I'm going to bless you like nobody's business. See, I have given you a wise and understanding heart. Here it is. So that there has not been anyone like you before you, nor any shall any arise after you. You're going to be the wisest man that ever lived. Nobody before you, nobody after you is going to have the wisdom you have, Solomon. Wow. Is that great? And I've also given you what you haven't asked for, riches, honor, so that there shall not be anyone like you among the kings all your days. This reminds me of a beautiful microcosm of Matthew 6:33. It says, seek first the kingdom of God and his righteousness, and all these things will be added unto you. You care about doing what's right before me, I'll bless your life. It's not always material blessing, but in this case, it sure was. He's going to be ridiculously wealthy, Solomon. I mean, ridiculous, the wealth he is going to hold. So he's just going to bless him above all that he can ever ask or think. And so now notice, the three things, remember, that we saw asked for in verse 11, long life, riches, and shortening life of your enemies. Notice what he says here. There's an if in verse 14. If you walk in my ways, which he had acknowledged his father David had done, I'll give you the long life. That one's contingent on you obeying me. If you walk in my ways to keep my statutes and my commandments as your father David walked, I'll lengthen your days. Okay, and then Solomon awoke. Wow. Now, I don't know about you, but the pessimist in me would wake up and go, oh, rats, it was only a dream. I'm the same fool I was when I went to bed, and I'm not going to be any smarter tomorrow. Oh, now, you know, these are great when you have a bad dream. You know, when you're a kid and you have those bad dreams, why is it we always have, I shouldn't poison your mind. Remember when you're a kid and you have a dream, you go to school without any clothes on? It's the weirdest dream. Everybody ever have that? Show of hands. You wake up, oh, thank you, I was dreaming. And this is the opposite. So Solomon's there, oh no, I was dreaming this, but he really did bless him. He really did, this really did happen. The Lord really is going to bless him. And indeed it's been a dream. And he came to Jerusalem and stood before the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord. Now why is he offering at the Ark now? Why the high places before and now this experience with God, now he goes to Jerusalem? It's just odd to me that it tells me Solomon probably knew he shouldn't have been going to the high places. He goes to the living God in the one place where the Ark of the Covenant was, the one picture of the presence of God. He comes to him when he knows God has ministered to him. So anyway, just interesting comparison between the beginning of this chapter and here. So he came to Jerusalem, stood before the Ark of the Lord, offered up burnt offerings, offered peace offerings, and made a feast for all of his servants. I love the offerings he chose to give. Burnt offering is a picture of a person completely consecrated, completely burned up to the Lord. None of my will, I'm all burned up. It's none of my desire, I'll obey you. And then peace offering is a picture of communing with God. And that was the one of the sacrifices where part of the meat was given back to the offerer. So I'm really communing with God and fellowshipping and eating with him. So he made this feast for all of his servants. So beautiful, beautiful scene here. He is now going to be the wisest man that ever lived. And we're going to immediately get a picture of a scene that will prove his incredible wisdom. Now, this is a passage that we probably all know, right? I mean, I wonder, who doesn't know the story of Solomon and the two women that came with the dead child? But let's read it. Two women who were harlots came to the king and stood before him. Now, I'm amazed right away Solomon would allow two harlots to come to him. I mean, aren't you? That tells me he's a humble king. He didn't say, okay, you have to be real righteous and pure and to come to me. No, justice is justice. Justice needs to be served. And so it's really beautiful that he was willing to serve these two women by hearing their case. So he didn't just let the people that helped him get into office. I'm joking. I mean, he didn't need help getting into office. David put him there. The Lord put him there. But you know what I mean? Today, it's like with politicians, I help those who help me. And so it's my people, those who put me into office. Well, David's willing to help people who are never going to help him. So beautiful picture of a servant king. So here they are. Okay, this is really a tragic scene. You can just grieve for this woman. The first woman, one woman said, my Lord, this woman and I dwell in the same house. I gave birth while she was in the house. So it's two harlots. They probably have no friends, just the two of them. They're both pregnant. And they're going to deliver so close, only 3 days apart. And so the first woman delivers her baby. Then it happened on the third day after I'd given birth. This woman also gave birth, and we were together. No one was with us in the house. Now, probably after 3 days later, no one had probably even seen the children to even look at birthmarks or anything. It's just the moms, likely, are the only ones that know what these babies look like. Now, never forget, there's no pictures in this day. There's no DNA testing. You don't know whose is who. I mean, you know, sometimes you just take out that baby picture and it's obvious that child belongs to her when you look at baby pictures, whatever. They didn't have any of that. And so, anyway, they're here together and they're in the house. Probably nobody's seen them except the two of us in the house. So this woman's son died in the night. She laid on him. Tragic. I mean, this is tragic. But it gets worse, if it could even get possibly worse, that one woman would accidentally roll over on her child and smother the child. And then she arose in the middle of the night and she took my son from my side. She swapped the babies. Ridiculous. Like, a woman did this. This is not a story written. This happened, that a woman really did this. I'm going to take her baby, put my dead baby in her by her side. And I mean, just can't even believe it. So while your maidservant slept, she laid him in her bosom and laid her dead child in my bosom. And when I arose in the morning to nurse my son, what a difference in this chapter. Solomon woke up, I'm going to be wise. This woman wakes up and realizes her child's dead. And how heartbroken. And she really experienced it until she really examined the child and realized this is not my child. Mom knows her child. And so she's already been looking at her child at least the 3 days and then however many days the other child has lived. And so, anyway, she realized that, and when I examined him in the morning, indeed, he was not my son whom I had born. It's not my son. And so she comes to the conclusion, she swapped. She took my child and gave me her dead son. So these two sons here, and then the other woman, no, but the living one is my son, the dead one is your son. And the first woman said, no, but the, and they get into this back and forth. No, you did it, no, you did it, and who's going to solve this? Now remember, today, slam dunk. Take some blood, go do a DNA test, done deal. Everybody knows. And you're going to figure this out. You can likely figure it out that day with testing. But they didn't have that. Now who's going to have the wisdom to figure this out? And because two are saying it, one's telling the truth, one's lying. They don't have two witnesses. How do you figure this out? And then here comes the wisdom of the Lord. So, verse 23, the king said, the one says, verse 20, he just repeats the story. The one says, this is my son who lives. Your son is the dead one. But the other says, no, but your son is the dead one and my son is the living one. Now, where you got to really go, wow, is after the story is over, you could look back and go, well, yeah, that's like, wow, that's obvious. You know, by the time the women react the way they do, this is obvious who the mom is. But who has the wisdom to think on their feet in a moment like this? And Solomon did it. And he's going to do it over and over and over as king because of this tremendous wisdom from the Lord. So the king says, bring me a sword. Now you wonder what's going through the mind of these. A sword, what's that going to do? What good is that? So that, now, at least hopefully the woman who's lying is going to, maybe he's going to use it on me in a minute. I don't know. So they brought a sword before the king. Now he never intended to use this sword. I don't know what he told the guy that brought the sword in. But okay, the king said, divide the living child in two. Give half to the one and half to the other. And I wonder, did he tell his guy that brought the sword in, hey, when I say what I'm about to say, all I want you to do is look at the women's facial expression and wait till you see what comes out of their mouth. That's what this is all about. Did he say that? It's not recorded. I don't know. But that's what Solomon's doing. He can't wait to see the responses out of the women. So, then the woman whose son was living, the one who knew it was her son, this is her living son. She doesn't want him to die. So she yearned with compassion for her son. He said, oh, my Lord, give her the living child. By no means kill him. Now, that's sacrificial love right there. I love my child so much, I'd let this wicked woman, I know you know, don't want to label, but she just swapped her baby. And I think about what she said. I'd let this woman who was willing to do that to raise my son. She's not safe, but it's better than death. You talk about sacrificial love. This is incredible what this woman is offering here just because she loves her child that much. And that should have been, case closed right there. But the other woman, if there's a slamming the door, she does it to make it clear who the mom is. So, because what does the other one say? Let's see. Oh, my Lord, give her the living child. By no means kill him. But the other said, let him neither be mine or yours. Divide him. Oh, wow. That's not the mom. I don't know anything about anything, but that's not the mom right there. Don't give that child to her. Even if she was, she doesn't deserve the child. Adopt her out to someone else. So that was it. So the king answered and said, give the first woman the living child. By no means kill him. She's his mother. And you know, everybody in the room's like, wow. Wow. That's what wisdom looks like in action. To just say that, it becomes obvious who's the right one. Man, that is just beautiful. So notice what happened. All Israel heard of the judgment which the king had rendered, and they feared the king. Now, this is really good to have a young king that people respect so much they fear him at a young age. You're not going to pull the wool over this guy's eyes. If you're going to go and bring a case before Solomon, you better be on the right side of justice. He's going to find you out. And because he's so wise, and so they feared him. And that's really great. You can imagine what would have settled in the hearts of the people. We've lost our king. We're only a couple years into this new king, his son. And wow, are we a blessed people. We've got a great, great king. So, you know, we all know what a blessing it is to have good, godly, wise leaders. That's what we would all hope for in people that are ruling over us. Proverbs 29:2 says, when the righteous are in authority, the people rejoice. But when a wicked man rules, the people groan. And they're rejoicing right here. We've got a great king in our midst. And they saw that the wisdom of God was in him to administer justice. So good. There's almost nothing more enraging than bad justice, which is not justice, but you know what I mean. So they're happy that this was going to go well for them with this king. So some quick applications. We need to stay far away from sin as we can, as far as we can. We see Solomon starting to play with and toy with sin early on. It's going to end up catching him very, very badly. We need to stay close to the Lord and his word and obey the Lord. He didn't do that. His original goals were good. He wanted to only obey the Lord, bless his people, judge them rightly, and that was his goal. And then he is going to get away from that personally. But also know that God is ready and willing to give us the wisdom we need to do the right thing in serving him. So again, look at this chapter and ask yourself, what would I ask of the Lord if he was to give me anything I wanted? Would I bless him by asking for something like this? Well, with all of this wisdom now, the next chapter we're going to see him establish basically the equivalent of his cabinet for a king. And so King Solomon was king over all Israel. These were his officials, and he begins to name them. First is Azariah, the son of Zadok, the priest. Elihoref and Ahijah. These three guys in the end of verse 2 and beginning of verse 3, they were the scribes. Now, first off, just a quick comment. Azariah, he's actually the grandson of Zadok. You may remember earlier, we never heard of a son with this name. This is the grandson. That was a common practice in that day to call grandson, still call him a son. But in 1 Chronicles 6, we're going to read, Zadok begot Ahimaaz, and Ahimaaz begot Azariah. And so here he is, a grandson, but then these other two guys, and they were scribes. Now, it's hard, honestly, to get the meaning of some of these Hebrew words. And so you're kind of, at some level, we're guessing a little bit what the roles were. I tend to think of the scribe, though, in this case, in the same way as the scribes of Jesus' day. I know a lot of them were not faithful to the Lord, but a scribe in that day was those that copied the law. They were scribes. They wrote things down. They were copyists of the law, so they became known as experts in the law. And I just tend to think these were kind of that same role. They were the ones that knew the law and would help the nation stay true. If you will, they'd be the equivalent of our kind of Department of Justice today. Lawyers, they're trying to make sure we're doing the right thing. And then I tend to think of it that way. Next is Jehoshaphat, the son of Ahilud, the recorder. Now, this is the guy that recorded minutes, if you will, recorded the major decisions made. It's interesting, the word recorder of him, Jehoshaphat, actually it literally means to remember or to recollect. So he wrote things down. You know, you ever go, you know, hey, what was that decision that was made a few months ago and what did we decide? He'd bring that information out. So he was the recorder something like the historian for the king. Benaiah, we met him a few times. Was it last week? When he's the guy that Solomon kept sending out to kill people that were disobedient and deserved death. And of course, he's an army guy. And so he became the leader over the army. Joab had been. He killed Joab because Solomon sent him to take him out for his cold-blooded murder earlier on in life. So he's now the new commander of the army. Zadok and Abiathar, the priests. I think Solomon is just very, very generous here, merciful, by even naming Abiathar as one of the priests. So I believe the order was he was the high priest. Zadok was with him and serving with him. Zadok becomes the high priest. If you remember, Abiathar effectively defected with Adonijah. And Solomon made it crystal clear, you deserve to die for what you did, but he let him live. He made him move to another city, get away, Anathoth, you can't stay with me, and be the priest. But he still names him. I mean, he's just gracious, a gracious leader to name him. So Zadok is really the leader. Azariah, the son of Nathan, we're not sure, but this could have been the prophet Nathan. And he was over the officers. Probably a very blessed young man with wisdom like his dad, Nathan. But he's even a leader over the officers. So he's a leader of leaders. Very wise, a man himself. After him was Zabad, the son of Nathan, a priest and the king's friend. Now, I'm encouraged when I read that. It's good to see there's another priest there, but he's close to Solomon. He's the king's friend. It's good to know the king has godly men that are close to him. Now, I don't know about you, but do you wonder, I mean, there's some really great godly men here in this list. Don't you wonder, I mean, I wonder when I look at his life, or you look at any leader, and sometimes there's this saying, you know, we've heard the saying, is he just surrounded by yes men? And I wonder, how much resistance or pushback were these men giving Solomon as he begins to marry wife number two, 200, 250? I mean, Solomon, come on. Did they try to stop him in this process? I tend to think they probably did. And so, I mean, we don't know. It's just worth thinking about. So we know as believers, if we see a friend in sin, we have firsthand knowledge, not supposed to be second or third-hand knowledge. With firsthand knowledge of sin, we're to confront that sin in love and be gentle, but we're supposed to confront that. So I just wonder if they did. But it's good to see he had godly people around him. Next is Abishar over the household of Adoniram, the son of Abda, over the labor force. So first, in verse 6, a man over his household, probably over all the servants of his house. And he must have had a ton of servants. When you see the amount of food they ate, his family, wow. And so he's over that. And then the man over the labor force, he's going to be over a lot of labor people. When they begin to build the temple, he's going to have many, many, many servants working with building the temple. And, of course, even just all the other servants of his house and everything. Anyway, this guy's over the labor force. Then we see that Solomon had 12 governors over all Israel who provided food for the king and his household. Each one made provision for 1 month of the year. Now, this is wisdom, too. He needs so much food. I don't know how many wives he had at this point, but by the time it's done, the amount of food they're going to need every day is ridiculous. And who's going to feed them for all that? So he breaks up this task of feeding his family over 12 regions of the country. And we're going to see that down later. Now, I have a map for you to look at if you want to see it, and we'll put that up for you. And you can go ahead and go to the second one. This is the same map, a little more blown up. The nice thing is you can see the numbers there. That's in order of the men as we're going to roll through here. One of the first things I do when I look at this is I wonder, was that tied to the 12 tribes? It's not. It's difficult to tell. Because you can see as you kind of break up the pieces and try to overlay that, it doesn't line up real great with the particular tribes. But he did split up the land pretty good. The most telling one to me is I don't see anybody in this name that lived in the area of his tribe. So he let all the other tribes pay for what he was doing and for all of his food. But anyway, because you notice the southern region below Benjamin, that number 11, there's nobody in the region of Judah providing for him. So all the other tribes had to do that. It makes me wonder partly if that's some of the conflict later between the northern and the southern tribes. But anyway, let's just look at this. We'll leave that up as we're going through it. You can kind of take a look. Oh, by the way, first, I do want to make a quick comment about 12, right? 12 is known as the number of government in Scripture, number of government. We have numbers. Some numbers mean very much things, right? 6 is man's number. 7 is God's number. 40 is the number of judgment. You've got, it rained for 40 days and 40 nights. They wandered for 40 years in the wilderness. These pictures. Well, 12 is the number of government. 12 tribes, 12 apostles. It's interesting the Lord has 12 months of the year. Even Ishmael, when he broke away from his dad and his brother, he ended up having 12 princes, which ended up becoming really most of the Muslim world and the Arab world. So anyway, very interesting. But he broke these up in the 12s. So a lot of wisdom. Let's move through these very quickly. There's Ben-Hur. We know the movie. It's not the guy. But Ben-Hur. See the word Ben? That's the name for son. It literally means son of Hur. So his dad's name was Hur. You see that 5 of these 12 have the name Ben something. Some think it's more like a nickname, but it may have been their formal name. But Ben-Hur, and where he's from the mountains of Ephraim. So if you look up there at number 1 on that map, you see right near the center, see Ephraim left of the number 1, that's where that guy was from. And so he was providing. And so some of these you can look over and try to get a guess. He really was from the area of Ephraim. We're going to end up finding about 3 of them really kind of come from the area of Manasseh on the west of the Jordan. That's where it doesn't really tie in well to the tribes. But that's the first one, Ben Decker in Makaz, Shaul Beam, Beth Shemesh, and Elon, Beth Hanan. That's the second one. And so he's really from the area that's basically the tribe of Dan. And then the next one, Beth Hesed in Aroboth, to him were belong Soko in the land of Hefer. And that one is in the area of the tribe of Manasseh. And then Ben Abinadab in verse 11, and that's the fourth one in all the regions of Dor. He had Tapheth, the daughter of Solomon, his wife. Hey, that guy. He's got Solomon as his father-in-law. There's actually 2 of these guys are married to Solomon's daughters. Him down, a guy down in verse 15. So he provided for Solomon, and he was from the area of kind of Asher and Manasseh up to the upper left on the map of Israel. Then Bana, the son of Ahilud, and Tanakh, Megiddo. That's Megiddo of the famed Valley of Armageddon up in the north of the country, and Beth Shan, which is beside Zaratan below Jezreel from Beth Shan to Abel. Mahola, as far as the other side of Jokneam. And so that one would have been also in the area of upper Manasseh. Ben Geber in Ramoth Gilead. That's to the east of the Jordan. You'll see Ramoth Gilead way out to the right of the map. Is that under the number 6? Is that what that number is there? Yeah. So the towns of Jair, sons of Manasseh, and Gilead, to him belong the region of Argob and Bashan. 60 large cities with walls and bronze gate bars. We'll go quickly through this. Ahinadab, the son of Iddo, in Mahanaim. That's the tribe of Gad in that region. Ahimaaz and Naphtali. Naphtali is a tribe, so that one's from there. He also took Basemath, the daughter of Solomon. That's the second son-in-law. Bana, the son of Hushai in Asher. And Aloth, that's up in the area of Asher for him. And then Jehoshaphat, the son of Peruah in Issachar. That's a tribe. Shimei, the son of Elah in Benjamin. That's a tribe just north of Judah. And then Geber, the son of Uri, in the land of Gilead, in the country of Sihon, king of the Amorites, and Og, king of Bashan. He was the only governor who was in the land, I think speaking of Og and Bashan in that region. Okay, so there it is. Those are the kings. Now let's look at what these guys had to do. Judah and Israel were as numerous as the sand by the sea in multitude, eating and drinking and rejoicing. So Solomon reigned over all kingdoms from the river to the land of the Philistines as far as the border of Egypt. They brought tribute and served Solomon all the days of his life. This is the largest landmass Israel ever oversaw. But they didn't just go to the Jordan. They went all the way out to the Euphrates River. And the reason we believe that is because you notice it says the river in verse 21. But if you look at verse 24, verse 24 said he had dominion over the region on this side of the river from Tifsa. That's a city that is on the Euphrates River on the west side. So all of that region, and that's what the Lord gave them way back in Genesis, all of that far region. They were never to conquer outside of that, but they did take control all the way up to that area while Solomon was king. Now let's look at the amount of food that they ate. Solomon's provision for one day. Did you catch that? Verse 22. One day was 20 cores of fine flour, 60 cores of meal. Now let me try to translate this for you. One core, so he's talking about 20 cores. One core is 6 1/4 bushels. And so 30 cores would be about 185 bushels. And they say, these are rough translations, one bushel, I'm going to give you a liquid measure, is about, one core was about 58 gallons, about 9 gallons per bushel. So you start doing some math on this, it's about the equivalent of 1,700 gallons of flour a day. Imagine a milk carton, 1,700 of those flour every day, and they're eating that. That's just the ground flour, because the meal speaks of, that's as kind of like the wheat that's not ground. And there's double that, 60 cores of that, about 3,500 gallons worth of raw, kind of unmulched wheat. So there's just phenomenal numbers. It's almost hard to wrap your mind around this kind of food that was brought. No wonder he spread out the providence of this food. Who could handle all of this? And then on top of that, 10 fatted oxen, and 20 from the pasture. So there's 30 oxen. Now, any of you ever bought a side of beef? How long did that last you? What, a half a winter or a winter? I mean, a season? I know you don't eat meat necessarily every night. He's eating 20 oxen a day. Oh, and of course, if that's not enough, we need 100 sheep. And then besides that, throw in a deer, gazelle, roebucks, a fatted fowl. This is just unbelievable amount of food that they're eating. Remember way back Solomon or Samuel had told a man, when you get a king, he's going to take your land and take your people, your young people, and the best of your young men and be in your war, fight for you. And man, look at all this food. Unbelievable what is being provided here. So we just try to get our minds around the size and scope of what is happening here. It makes you think he really had been feeding more than just his family. I mean, you think, was he feeding his army with this? Just an amazing amount. But I don't know if this is looking forward. Did he start out with just a couple cores, and then by the time the more wives come in and up the amount of wheat? Anyway, pretty amazing. So, because they didn't have to deal with gluten and all that, right? It's all natural wheat back then. So, no gluten-free diets back then. All right. And Judah and Israel dwelt safely, each man under the vine and under his fig tree. And they really had a blessed time from Dan as far as Beersheba, all the days of Solomon. So he really, really was blessed. By the way, this phrase, under the, what does this say, under the vine and the fig, that's why those are two of the images or imagery of Israel. Jesus talked about when the fig tree has bloomed and blossomed in Matthew 24, talking about the end times. It's an image of Israel. This is one of those places. And this imagery of being at rest, resting under that, is used. It's in Micah 4 and Zechariah 3 as images of this kind of a time of rest and everybody being under these at rest. Okay, let's move on as we get close to closing. Solomon had 40,000 stalls of horses. Now, let me say, I do think this is a copyist error. The word 40 there, likely a footnote in your Bible. In the first, it's a Second Chronicles 9, the equivalent passage here, there it's 4, and I believe the 4 is the accurate number. In fact, much of the Septuagint translations to Greek translated this, even this verse, 4,000 stalls of horses. And so, I mean, where would even put 40,000 horses? But 4,000 horses for his chariots and 12,000 horsemen. I don't know how you put 12,000 horsemen on 40,000 horses, but I think it's the smaller number. If it's the larger number, you begin to wonder if he's violating the command not to multiply horses in Deuteronomy 17 for the kings. Although at some level, when you look at the size of his army, even 40,000 may not have been bad. A lot of people look at this as, it's 40,000 and he violated, I'm not so sure, with the size of Israel. God's big concern, though, was in multiplying horses, he would rely on them rather than the power of the Lord as his military might and protection. And that, of course, would be a big mistake if a king did that. But anyway, I don't see a problem with 4,000 here, but some do with this. So on top of that, the governors, now he's talking about the governors back in verse 7 who provided all that food. They also had to take care of the horses in terms of food. So they provided food for King Solomon, for all who came to King Solomon's table. There was no lack in supply. They also brought barley. Here's where they brought for the horses and the straw to the proper place for the horses and steeds, each man according to his charge. And God gave Solomon wisdom and exceedingly great understanding and largeness of heart. It's an interesting description, isn't it? Largeness of heart. And you look at that, and you know, we kind of shy away from using the word heart. That is the same Hebrew word that's in Jeremiah 17. The heart is deceitful above all things and desperately wicked. Who can know it? So a largeness of heart. It was also used in a kind of a context of like the seat of emotions. You know, the way we talk today about, you know, I love him with all my heart. You know, we're not looking at that negative vein in that way. But he really did give him a heart for people, a heart for wisdom, a heart for learning, like the sand on the seashore. Thus Solomon's wisdom excelled the wisdom of all the men of the East and all the wisdom of Egypt. Now, it almost seems redundant to mention him, and then in a minute he's going to mention some of the men he's wiser than. He's the wisest man that ever lived. So there's no need to compare. But it is interesting the Lord does name that he's wiser than all of the men and all of the wisdom of Egypt. He was wiser than all men, and then he names a few. Now, you have to admit, it'd be pretty impressive to get on this list, wouldn't it? How'd you like to be in this list? Ethan the Ezraite, we don't know hardly anything about these. This guy's interesting. Let me make sure I get the number right. Ethan the Ezraite, he wrote one of the Psalms, Psalm 89. If you look at that Psalm, it's the only one we know of. But he got his name down on that. Let me just read you the first line. You know, the introduction, who wrote the Psalms? Let me read Psalm 89, verse 1. Well, actually, it's even kind of before verse 1. It literally says, a contemplation of Ethan the Ezraite. So he got his name in the book there. So the other ones we don't know, Heman, Chalcol, Darda, the sons of Mahal, and his fame in all the surrounding. These guys had fame all over. And then Solomon makes them look like little grade schoolers here. So you don't got nothing on Solomon. And so he spoke 3,000 Proverbs. Now, do you like to read the Proverbs for wisdom? Great Proverbs. Solomon wrote those. So there's various places that we're told in the Proverbs. In fact, Proverbs 1, the Proverbs of Solomon, the son of David, king of Israel. That's just 31 of them. Of course, you can argue whether he wrote the last one and some other issues, but he wrote 3,000 Proverbs. And you look at all of them packed with wisdom. Where did he get all this wisdom? It's from the Lord. So 3,000 Proverbs. And his songs were 1,005. I don't know who added those up. Pretty precise number. But that's what he wrote. By the way, he wrote Psalm 82 and Psalm 127. Those are introduced as from Solomon. So Solomon was the author of those songs. Those are two of those 1,005 songs. But of course, I think his greatest writing, I believe, was the Song of Solomon. So the love story and the song that he wrote. And so those were three of his songs. And on top of that, he spoke of trees from the cedar tree of Lebanon, even to the hyssop that springs out of the wall. Of all things to mention, cedar trees, going to use a lot of cedar trees to build the temple. And but notice the hyssop. I love that he mentioned that because Solomon is a picture of the King of Peace. And our Jesus is a King of War and a King of Peace. He's both. He's going to come and destroy his enemies, but he's also a King of Peace. And so I almost feel like you see almost a little bit of the King of War in David and the King of Peace in his son Solomon. But he mentions the hyssop, which was, of course, the bushy plant that was used to dip in the blood to touch the lintel and the doorpost in Egypt before they left Egypt. And then it makes its appearance at the cross when they use the hyssop to lift up the wine to Jesus on the cross. So beautiful imagery here. So he knew all about this stuff. He could talk about them. I mean, wouldn't you just love to drive down the freeway and name every tree and tell all about it and how it grows? He could do that. And not just trees. It mentions here the trees, how the hyssop springs out of the wall. He could speak of animals, of birds, of creeping things, and of fish. And he was so impressive that the men of all nations, from all the kings of the earth who had heard of his wisdom, came to hear the wisdom of Solomon. People came from all over just to listen to Solomon because he was so smart. Man, we remember the story of Queen of Sheba. We'll get to her a little bit later. But she came and was like, man, even the half of how smart you were and wise wasn't told to me. what God has done for you is quite a blessing. So anyway, this interesting chapter, God is a God of order. Solomon takes his wisdom and orders his cabinet, sets things in order, uses it to establish how to properly feed himself, his family, all these things. It's a beautiful picture. I can't believe how much they ate, but they did. And then, but you know what's great? You look at this and you go, man, I'll never be like Solomon. But I think I ended last week with this. But let me just remind you again, James chapter 1. God is ready to pour his wisdom upon all of his children. And when we need it, if we cry to him, he wants to give us wisdom. And let me just remind you, you may look at this and go, I'll never be like that. I'll just be a fool the rest of my life. Just remember, if anyone lacks wisdom, let him ask of God, who gives to all liberally and without reproach. He gives liberally. He wants to bless you and I with wisdom as we walk in this world. You have to believe him, because he goes on to say, let him ask in faith with no doubting. He who doubts is like a wave of the sea, driven and tossed by the wind. For let not that man suppose he will receive anything from the Lord. Ask the Lord for wisdom. He'll gladly give it to you. Gladly. It may only be for a moment. At least you had a moment, a glimpse, and keep seeking him for more and more. I think he likes to give us as we need it, so we have to keep coming back. If he just poured it on you, we have the risk, we run the risk of then living and taking this life for granted, as Solomon did. And so I like that the Lord keeps us dependent by just giving us wisdom as we need it and when we need it. I think that's the safer life for us. And the Lord knows we need it to be that way. So anyway, wonderful truths here. Let me pray. We'll open up for a couple of quick questions. So, Father, thank you for these two chapters, just blessed truths in them. And we just thank you and praise you for them, all that you have for us. May we learn from them, Lord. And I do pray and I believe that you want everyone in this room to know you and to walk with you and to have your wisdom and to have it when we need it, even when we need to think on our feet. And so you'll be faithful, and we trust you for that. Lord, help us to have faith. Help us to trust you and not be pushed around by every wind of doctrine and all these things, and to just believe you for great things, as Solomon did. And we thank you and praise you for these truths, we ask in Jesus' name. Amen.